From the St. Louis Public Radio Newsroom, this is The Gateway. It's Monday, August 25th. I'm Abby Larico. While I've been on leave the past few months, it's been a busy summer for our newsroom and in our community. Sunday marked 100 days since a deadly tornado swept through the St. Louis region, and we're still learning more about the depth of the devastation. Things look very different in Clayton than they do in St. Louis's Greaterville neighborhood.
These are the people that's, let's be honest, that's kind of forgotten about, and things kind of get swept up under the rug here.
STLPR's Kayvon Mansouri walks us along the tornado's path 100 days later. That's coming up after this news on The Gateway. A man is now charged with first-degree murder for the shooting death of an off-duty campus police officer 17 years ago. St. Louis Public Radio's Sarah Fenton reports witnesses say the shooting of Damon Taylor was a case of mistaken identity.
Police arrested Brandon Levy, who was 29 years old at the time of the shooting, which happened in the Academy neighborhood. According to a probable cause statement, three witnesses identified Levy as the person who shot Taylor, who worked as a law enforcement officer at St. Louis Community College, Florissant Valley. At a press conference Saturday, St. Louis Circuit Attorney Gabe Gore commended detectives' efforts.
I hope that this brings some comfort to the family. Number one, demonstrating that their loved one, Damon Taylor, was not forgotten, and the tragedy that he was a victim of was not forgotten.
Police made the arrest after interviewing a third witness last month. I'm Sarah Fenton, St. Louis Public Radio.
A detainee at the St. Louis jail is in critical condition after suffering an unknown medical emergency Friday morning. The 43-year-old woman was in police custody and in the prisoner processing unit when the incident occurred. Police say medical staff arrived and revived the woman before she was taken to a hospital. As of Friday afternoon, police say the unidentified woman was in poor shape and that death was imminent. 20 people have died in custody of the jail since 2020. Public safety officials noted that when detainees are being booked at the jail, they are technically still in police custody. The Phelps County Jail will no longer house ICE detainees. St. Louis Public Radio's Jonathan All reports county officials say the federal reimbursement is not adequate to cover the costs.
The jail in Rolla has housed more than 350 ICE detainees since Trump's immigration raids started in March. But the county will no longer take in any new detainees at the end of the month. Lucy Barrett is with Abide in Love, an activist group that has been helping ICE detainees. She says the group is concerned about where the detainees may end up instead of Phelps County.
We did have a pulse on what was happening to people in our community, and we thought that we were able to, help improve their experience a little bit. And so now we don't know where those detainees will go and what their experience will be like.
The federal government pays $85 a night to house an ICE detainee, but that comes with transportation and administrative costs. In Rolla, I'm Jonathan All, St. Louis Public Radio.
A St. Louis man who provided security for Congressman Wesley Bell during a town hall last Tuesday has been put on administrative leave by his employer. Affinia Healthcare said in a statement Friday that the company was made aware of a disturbing video where a staffer was providing security in a private capacity not related to the company. Bell's town hall became contentious Tuesday evening after protesters criticized him over his support of Israel and its war in Gaza that's killed tens of thousands of Palestinians. Videos showed security guards, some plain-clothed and some in uniform, pushing protesters to the ground. Affinia says it is conducting an investigation. Another lawmaker from Missouri is not shying away from doing town hall meetings while Congress is in recess. Congressman Mark Alford is planning a four-day swing through the 4th Congressional District, which takes in portions of the Kansas City area and mid-Missouri. Alford, who's a Cass County Republican, acknowledges recent town halls have gotten contentious, but he says he doesn't believe that members of Congress should stop doing them.
If we are going to improve our democracy and our republic, we've got to start having conversations. We've got to listen, and we've got to exchange ideas and try to win each other over through argumentation and not emotion.
You can listen to Alford's interview on the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air at stlpr.org. A Republican state lawmaker from Jefferson County has died. State Representative Ken Waller died over the weekend at the age of 63. He was in his third year representing a portion of Jefferson County in the House and was chairman of the Pensions Committee. Waller served as Jefferson County's first county executive in the 2010s. He said in 2023 that he didn't think being a state legislator was a step down from his prior offices.
I thought it's time to give back to my community in a smaller sense, and I think that's why the transition was much simpler.
Waller is survived by his wife, his three children, and a grandchild. Federal and state policymakers are considering substantial regulations on artificial intelligence programs. As St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum reports, they're expected to face major pushback from technology companies.
Missouri U.S. Senator Josh Hawley has introduced legislation that could allow people to sue if their data is used to train AI models without their permission. While even some leaders of AI companies welcome regulation, Oliver Roberts of the WashU Law AI Collaborative says there are fears that the restrictions could stifle innovation.
If tech companies have to go and get express permission from every single individual person and therefore data point, then it's going to slow down the growth of artificial intelligence and potentially stunt the U.S.'s AI development.
AI companies unsuccessfully pushed to preempt state laws on the technology in the recently enacted One Big Beautiful Bill. I'm Jason Rosenbaum, St. Louis Public Radio.
The St. Charles City Council unanimously passed a one-year ban on data center applications during a special session Friday. The resolution bans the acceptance of applications to establish or expand data centers. This comes after a proposed data center spurred public outrage in recent weeks in St. Charles. Missouri's utilities are working on new rate plans for big data centers. St. Louis Public Radio's Kate Grumke reports they're trying to both attract businesses and protect existing customers.
The policies are for customers who will use huge amounts of energy, like data centers. Ameren wants these companies to commit to staying in the region for at least 15 years in exchange for the utility building new power plants. Steve Wills is Ameren's Senior Director for Regulatory Affairs.
While we want to attract the economic development benefits, we need to have a framework where we can actually get some assurance about their commitment to the region before we make the investments in some of the infrastructure we need to serve them.
The proposed rates for data centers are being considered by Missouri's Public Service Commission. The plans likely won't be finalized until early next year. I'm Kate Grumke, St. Louis Public Radio.
It's now been 100 days since a deadly tornado tore through the St. Louis region May 16th, damaging or destroying at least 10,000 buildings. St. Louis Public Radio's Kayvon Mansouri found progress since depends on where you're walking in the tornado's path.
It's quiet as I walk down Parkdale Avenue in Clayton. This is one of the first neighborhoods in the path of the worst tornado to hit St. Louis since 1959. As I walk through Clayton, in some places, it's hard to tell a tornado came through. Sure, some buildings are badly damaged, but the debris is gone. I run into Sonny Solanke, who lives in the neighborhood. He's out on a run. He remembers the day of the tornado well.
Me, I was showering. I jumped out. I heard my ceiling rattling. I looked through my windows. I saw debris flying up the street. Then I saw a tree in front of my yard disintegrating, and I saw roofs kind of falling apart. It went dark. And then there was light, and I thanked every higher power on this planet.
As we stand in front of a condemned apartment building, one of the hardest hit in the neighborhood, he recalls crews from Clayton, Richmond Heights, University City, and Webster Groves helping with debris cleanup.
I mean, they've done a really great job, but yeah, I mean, this is a continual process. I think the trees you'll see the stubs all over the place like that one.
And it's true. As I walk the neighborhood, it's hard to find debris in the area, and outside of damaged homes that appear to be in repair, things seem to be looking up. I continue walking the path of the tornado over several days to see firsthand how neighborhoods throughout the city are recovering and talking with neighbors about their experiences. Later, I find myself on Wydown Boulevard near Forest Park.
Many of the houses are missing roofs and windows are blown out, and scaffolding surround the homes. There are big junk dumpsters kind of everywhere. But for the most part, debris is gone in these neighborhoods. There's not much of it.
from what I can see, repairs on these houses are underway and in some cases nearly done. Across Forest Park on DeGiverville, these older brick homes fared far worse, and the repairs are taking longer. Here, repairs are underway on roofs, foundations, and more. As our visuals editor Brian Munoz and I walk down the street, we see Joanna Jacks talking with workers in her yard.
Good morning.
Hello. How are you doing?
The tornado blew the roof off her 113-year-old home into her front yard while she and her husband James were at a doctor's appointment.
We left 15 minutes before it touched down. The back of my roof, because I still got the front.
Yeah, you can see. You can see the sky through the window.
Yeah, I got skylight.
Yeah.
You got to pay for yours. Mine was free. That's what I tell people.
And indeed, as we reach her second floor, where a roof should be instead is clear blue skies. The entire back end of her home's roof is gone.
When I got out the car, my knees buckled. I almost fainted.
Workers are repairing the home, a process that could take a year. She and her husband sleep in an air-conditioned room near the front of the house with their dogs, Shy and Suki. They'll need to be out of the house soon.
I just keep it. When we've been here so long, it's hard to pack. After I've been here for over almost 50 years.
It's a similar story throughout this street. We talked to several neighbors that say while their homes survived, they'll be displaced until repairs are made. We make our way to the Greaterville. The difference here is stark. Almost every house is damaged, and many more have completely collapsed. We walk down Cope Brilliant Avenue.
Not much work happening here. Boarded up. Many of these brick buildings collapsed, and no repairs going on. And many seemingly condemned or at least unlivable. Lots with a roof that have just kind of collapsed. And the streets are somewhat empty.
In this devastated neighborhood, the quiet mirrors Parkdale Avenue, but debris fills the streets, and there aren't nearly as many workers repairing homes. Joe Wood, who owns Black Brothers Flooring, sits outside a building on Deer Street where repairs are underway.
If you look right through this area, still so much trash and debris, like in the streets, and we got buildings that's still down and bricks everywhere, and just a lot of trash and debris that still needs to be cleaned up.
Wood lives nearby. He says he's surprised at how quiet the area has been the past few weeks.
I mean, everybody was out here when it first happened, but I don't see anybody out here anymore, though.
Further down the path on Elm Bank Avenue, Natalie Hughes, known as the Brick Lady, climbs down scaffolding to come talk to us.
Hey, Vaughn.
Nice to meet you.
So? How you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty hot one, huh?
Yes.
You're up on the roof.
Yep.
Her crew arrived before dawn to start work, to avoid the heat on a day when the heat index hit 107 degrees. The summer's grueling heat means workers can't go all day as they try to fix rooftops. Hughes has workers throughout this area working on repairing buildings. She says they've taken on a lot of work for those who can't afford it. But for some, she says, these century-old houses are beyond repair or just too expensive to fix.
All of the homeowners are desperately trying to get their homes together. So sometimes the number gets a little more than people can handle. So, you know, that's understandable.
While some homes undergo work in the streets we walk, many are empty, only silent piles of rubble.
So I'm just trying to get people to not give up. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that I already know the city's going to come back. The question is, with whom and how?
Hughes jumps in her truck and takes off to another work site. And we head further north to the corner of Newstead and San Francisco Avenue.
So here on Newstead Avenue, this house has a giant opening. A tree has collapsed on, and there's just running water actually just like kind of spraying out of the basement. It was like this yesterday actually when I came by. I was wondering if it was just a one-off, but it's still going.
Across the street, James Hudson sits in his wheelchair watching the water spout out from the building.
Tree came down during the tornado, and the water burst like last week.
And just running.
And
nobody's
been
come
running
out?
All the time. Nobody come out.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, thank you. Appreciate
and I've been trying to stop, you know, to see these trucks that come through and stuff. And they had one guy over there cutting grass or something. And I told him to tell him that the water was running. And he said, you know, it wasn't his problem.
Folks across this area say the same thing. They wonder why the city isn't doing more to remove debris, fix issues like this, and make things more livable in the area. From here, the tornado continued, leaving a trail of devastation to the northeast and crossing the Mississippi River, damaging parts of Pontoon Beach and Granite City before finally dissipating. Repairs continue throughout the path of the storm, but people I talk to here in the Greaterville are worried. They aren't sure what the future looks like for this historic neighborhood. I'm Kayvon Mansouri, St. Louis Public Radio.
Our Brian Moline edited that piece. The Gateway is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, a listener-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Music by Ryan McNeely of Adult Fur. I want to say a quick thanks to Aula Kuziz and Jonathan All for all of their early mornings during my precious parental leave period, to all of my hardworking newsroom colleagues during this intensely newsy summer, and to you, the community of STLPR, for the heartening display of support over the past few months. I'm so proud to come back to work here. I'm Abby Larico, and from the St. Louis Public Radio Newsroom, this has been The Gateway.